Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 3rd, 2006. Today's session is entitled Unholy Ground and Environmental Problems at Holden Mine, presented by Rick Dunning. The number is DU-W-2006-3. Let's listen in.
I'm the curator of Holden's Museum. And before I start on this program, I thought I'd just make you aware of some other programs this week at the museum. I'm being assisted by Linda Jensen, who grew up here in Holden during the mining days, and she'll be presenting some programs on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of this week related to mine history and related to the community and what that was like to live here during the mining days as a young girl and attend the Holden School. So keep an eye on the kiosk for her programs as well. The program today deals with sort of the aftermath of that mining activity and the parts of it that we have to live with today. Of course, live in this wonderful pristine wilderness here. We're here for a short time or a longer time. But that pristine wilderness is also marred slightly by the presence of this old mine and all the piles of material left by the mining activity. And so I want to talk a little bit first about the mining process and how the tailings got to be where they are. You have a better sense of that, and then what kinds of problems the mine and the tailings pose environmentally, and then what some of the proposals are for trying to deal with those problems. We can skip over the map. So this is the mining operation in the late 1930s, shortly after it got started. Here's the village. So we're sitting here in the one end of what was an old dorm during the mining days for the miners. But now, of course, it's been converted to program space. This is Copper Mountain. Easy to remember because that's where the mine is. The big structure across the valley was their concentrating mill. We'll talk about that in just a second. The mine entrance actually is about right here on the mountainside, the same elevation as the top of the mill building. You can see a few other piles of ore up on the mountainside. Those are higher access tunnels. Essentially, the ore body is a layer of rock that begins along the edge where you see those piles and then essentially plunges vertically down through the mountain. So the tunnel went into the mountain a half a mile. And when they begin their mining process, they mined upward above the main tunnel, got all of that ore by about 1945. That was pretty easy because there the ore is dropping down towards your tunnel, so it's easier to get out. Gravity's working for you. After 1945, they started to go below the main tunnel. It gets a little harder because then you've got to haul it up before you can get it out of the mountain. From top to bottom, the mine is over half a mile. So the bottom of the mine workings is well below the level of Railroad Creek. From side to side, it's about half a mile wide. And that ore layer was about 80 feet thick. They worked on 14 different levels up and down inside the mountain, blasting rock out of that ore layer, bringing it out the main tunnel, across into the mill building, where it was processed, where it was concentrated. The problem they had with the ore in Copper Mountain is that it's a low-grade ore. It's only about 2% valuable metal and 98% worthless rock. So it's not the sort of thing you can dig out of the ground and just ship off down the hill to be processed. They took the rock out of the mountain, sent it into the mill building, and it went down through a series of crushing machines. And the crushing machines would take that hard rock, and this is all rock that's harder than steel. The crushing machines would grind that hard rock ultimately into powder. finer than the sand in the fire ring here. And then at about this level in the mill building, that powdered ore would go into big flotation tanks, big tanks of water 10 feet deep, with air bubbling up through them. And they added chemicals to those flotation tanks that would stick to the valuable minerals and make those float to the top. So the separation was done by a flotation system. The chemicals are called xanthates. They're organic chemicals engineered for the mining industry. Dow Chemical makes them. Other companies make them for the mining industry. It's sort of like a special soap that only washes valuable dirt. So the good stuff floats to the top, and the waste rock stays on the bottom. And there were several of those flotation tanks here in a series, so the ore would go from one tank to the other until they got as much of the ore out as possible. Then it would go into a drying bin to get the water out of it. They'd load it into buckets here at the bottom of the mill, and then trucks would drive it down to Lake Chelan, be loaded onto a barge, taken down lake, eventually loaded onto a rail train, and taken to the city of Tacoma, Washington, for the final processing at a smelter there in Tacoma. And in the heat of the smelter furnace, that's when the pure metals finally separate out at different temperatures. Here, the idea was to take the raw ore and get it into a more concentrated form. So they went from 2% good stuff to about 40% good stuff by the time they concentrated it. In this mine, the primary product was copper, but they also extracted gold, silver, and zinc. Those were their four metals. Of course, once you've taken the good stuff out in your concentrator mill, the stuff at the bottom of the tank, the stuff that's left over, is the waste rock, and that's what makes the tailings. Now, this is early in the mining stage, so you don't see much of a tailings pile here, just a settling pond on the valley bottom. Remember, the tailings were coming out of the flotation tanks mixed with water, so it's a slurry of ground-up rock and water. So they could just pipe it down the valley through big wooden pipes and into a settling pond here, and the rock would settle out. And I'll show you in a moment how that led to the formation of those tailings piles. Plenty of seats over here if you want to come on through and sit down, don't worry. Just a quick look at the interior of the mine, sorry, I went right past that. Well, we talked about it, so we'll go on. This is what we're left with today. What you see across the valley now is the wreckage of the mill building. On top of this first higher pile is the mine tunnel, still going into the mountains. You can see some of the higher access tunnels up the valley side. These bigger, higher piles consist of not the tailings that were processed by the mill, but big rock chunks that came out of the tunnels during the tunneling operation that they had to get out of the way. But any of the rock that actually went through the mill was processed and turned into these tailings piles. So first they created pile one. When that got too big, then they went to pile two. When that got too big, then they started pile three, and that was what they were working on as they shut down. Today, those tailings cover about 80 acres of the valley bottom. I said we'd talk a little bit more about how they constructed the tailings piles. First, they had to get Railroad Creek out of the way. So to make room on the valley bottom, it was just a meandering river in this section of the valley all over the valley bottom. So they shoved Railroad Creek over to this side of the valley where we are, held it in place with log cribbing. There's still some of that you can find exposed along the creek in various places. A lot of it's rotted away now. And then that gave them space on the valley bottom to make their settling ponds. So they made a dike out of coarser material, coarser tailings material, and they just sluice the tailings in behind that dike. And again, the water or the rock settles out in that settling pond. The water is siphoned off. When one settling pond fills up, they just build another dike on top of that. When that settling pond fills up, they build another dike on top of that. They just grow the tailings upward and then further and further down the valley as the mining process continued. Now, when the mine was operating, the mine and the mill ran three shifts a day, 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. And the mill was capable of processing 2,000 tons of rock a day. So once the mine was up and running, they ground up a lot of ore. And again, you can get a sense of that when you see the tailings photos. Sorry, it's getting a little jumpy on me there. These are what the tailings looked like about mid-1980s. Big orange piles. Again, you see the wreckage of the mill building, what's left of that. But that was the visually dominant element of this part of the valley. It still is in many ways, but less so now than it used to be. So one of the problems we faced is simply the visual impact of this mine and the tailings piles on the wilderness around it. You can see these for miles and miles up and down the valley, from the highest peaks and even from some neighboring valleys. It can be spotted, at least in their previous form before they were covered, they could be spotted by weather satellites and other kinds of satellites from space. That's such a big pile. In the springtime, you get water that ponded up on the surface a little bit, such as we see here. That's just snow melt, but it pretty quickly soaked in. And most of the year, or most of the summer, it looked like this, just big dry piles, barren piles. Again, this was about 1989 when this photo was taken. One of the reasons they're so barren is that this ore is a sulfide ore. In other words, most of the metals are mixed with sulfur to make the minerals that constitute the ore body. So in the grinding up process, you release some of that sulfur, creates fairly acidic conditions, difficult for most plants to grow on. They're also fairly dry in the summertime because the water soaks in so quickly. You can see one of the other problems, dust blowing off the piles. And we'll come back to that dust problem in just a moment here. Virtually throughout its history, Holden has wrestled with what to do with the tailings or how to get something done about the tailings. So that early leaders were writing to members of Congress and Forest Service leaders and whoever they could to try and have something done to take care of what was left from the mining activity. Holden itself has experimented with several ways of trying to deal with this aftermath from the mining. For a while, Holden sprinkled sewage effluent on the piles. That was part of our sewage treatment plant. So after primary treatment, then the effluent was sprinkled up on the piles. That provided a couple beneficial things in terms of vegetation. It provided moisture and organic matter, and it did help to establish some vegetation on part of pile number one. And we'll look at that in a moment. You'll see some of that vegetation that's been growing there. Unfortunately, that's not allowed by the health department anymore, so we don't use that practice. We send our sewage down through a septic tank and drain field system now. One of the fun experiments that was tried was to grow Jerusalem artichokes on the tailings as a plant that might do well in a dry, acidic environment. It wasn't to eat the artichokes. It was to perhaps distill them to make an alcohol supplement for fuel for the vehicles. The artichokes grew reasonably well. The distilling process for the fuel didn't work so well. But that was another experiment. Someone experimented once with making cement blocks out of the tailings material. We had one of those up in the museum. Someone even once tried making paint out of this tailings material. One of the popular suggestions through the years for getting rid of the tailings was just to give every visitor that comes up to the village a plastic bag and let them take a bag home with them. At one point, point, the village did consider the possibility of whether the tailings could be reprocessed to get some of the remaining minerals out, especially the gold out that still remains in the pile. Now, the mill operated about 90% efficiency on the copper and about 85% efficiency on the gold, so that does mean there is some gold left in the piles. And this truck, in fact, was from a belonged to a mining engineer. It's got a drill, got drill equipment on the back, so that he went out and took samples down through the piles and then assayed those samples to see what the gold content was like. And at least at that point, it wasn't economically feasible to consider reprocessing. The idea being that maybe if you reprocess them, that the gold might help to pay for disposing of the tailings in a more environmentally sound manner. But wasn't feasible at that point. As I say, the biggest problem was the dust. And you got a few shots here of the blowing dust. Now, these aren't loose piles. This isn't loose material because, remember, it's laid down in water. So it's layered material, somewhat cohesive. It's not cemented together like a rock, but it's somewhat cohesive because of how it was deposited in the water. This is the surface of the piles. There was a crust. But as this crust broke up from natural weathering processes, that produced the lighter material that the wind could pick up and blow around. So this was a common sight in the village on a windy day. Clouds of orange dust billowing across the valley. There were even sand dunes down at the lower end of the pile. And here, on a really bad windy day, this is what it could look like in parts of the village. An almost orange-out conditions instead of white-out conditions. Mm-hmm. And of course, if it would get into your eyes, into your lungs, particularly if you had breathing problems, it was irritating. There were some concerns about health effects of breathing in this kind of dust long-term. So the air pollution, the air quality issues surrounding this blowing dust were the primary worry in terms of environmental issues. But also, there was some concern about pollution getting into Railroad Creek. Water, as it filters down through the piles, it seeps into the creek. There's sulfur in the piles, so the water becomes a little bit acidic as it goes through. The acidic water dissolves metals out of the piles, so you get heavy metals out of this. Remember, this is all ground up ore, so the heavy metals from that are carried into the creek in solution form. Here you see remnants of that log cribbing rotting away, and there was some concern that if this cribbing disappeared, that the creek might start to erode into the tailings piles and wash more of the tailings downstream into the lake. So there were some water quality concerns along with the air quality concerns. So in 1990, the Forest Service began a remediation plan in which they hoped to accomplish several things. Top of the list was the dust, the wind erosion problems. They wanted to improve the aesthetic quality of the valley and make the tailings not so ugly, try and get them covered with vegetation. There was some concern about water draining out of the mine, that might also be polluted, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. The water seeping out of the tailings being eroded by the stream. And also they did a few things to try and improve the fish habitat in the stream as part of this project. So they initiated a two-year project to try and deal with the tailings. The main part of that was to cover the tailings with gravel. And so the gravel came from a gravel pit down by the top of the switchbacks right here in the valley, some glacial sediments that they were able to use. And cover the tailings with gravel and then create islands of topsoil and plant vegetation in those islands of topsoil so that the trees could spread out and eventually cover the whole tailings piles. So here is summer of 1990, kind of midway through the process of covering the tailings. The gray stuff on the surface is the gravel. The orange triangles are where the soil islands would go. They figured to cover about 10% of the soil or the pile surface with soil islands. They're triangular shaped because that's a little easier shape to make with a dump truck than a circle. And so for two summers, 90 and 91, dump trucks came up the road. They had their own bridge just downstream of the tailings piles. And those dump trucks, load after load after load, covered those tailings with about 4 to 6 inches of gravel. This is a schematic of what the soil islands would look like. Again, topsoil and slash and organic debris and then plants put in there. They also put some channels on the uphill side of the tailings to divert water around the pile so that if you've got meltwater and rainwater coming down the mountainside, instead of letting it go through the tailings, divert it around the tailings, and that they hoped would solve the water seepage issue in the tailings piles. They also had some channels on the surface of the tailings to channel snowmelt off the surface so that that wouldn't accumulate and soak down through. They wanted to protect the side of the tailings, the base of the tailings, with riprap. So they got some large boulders, some large rocks from down valley and brought those up and put those along the base of the pile. So that, in simplest terms, was how they tried to address it. This is what the tailings pretty much look like today. You can see the gray gravel cover. You can see splotches of green out there that represent the soil islands. In effect, it became kind of a Forest Service experiment station. You can see some test plots here, and there were more of them on the second pile. They experimented with different kinds of vegetation to see what would grow best here, different combinations of vegetation. Some they irrigated, some they didn't irrigate. Some they fertilized, some they didn't fertilize. Just trying different things to see what sort of vegetation you could get established on these tailings. These bigger trees were the ones that resulted from the village's sprinkling efforts in the 1970s, so they're pretty well established. You can see one of the channels across the surface of pile one here. The one place they couldn't get much gravel would be the side of the piles, especially pile two, because that's so steep. They draped some erosion control fabric down the sides of the piles. And the gravel cover certainly has done a tremendous job of stopping the dust problem. We don't have the same kind of air pollution, air quality issues that we had before this remediation effort. And you can get a sense that they're able to start getting some vegetation going. So here's some of the slash, some little trees planted out here. There have been some volunteer plants coming in, lupin and alder and other kinds of seeds blowing in, getting a start in this gravel cover. And so that part is also optimistic, that eventually the piles could be revegetated and blend in visually with the rest of the wilderness around them. And you wouldn't have the same big orange piles dominating the valley. So those parts of the 1990-91 project certainly were successful. The price tag for that project was about $4.5 million. Those covered over. That was some of the experimental vegetation plots. Here's one of the channels that, again, siphons water off the top of the piles. Here's some of the riprap on the base of the piles to protect it from erosion. Now, the one thing they weren't able to do too much with was the water coming out of the mine portal, the mine tunnel. So this is a shot of the old portal structure. The water was seeping out of there. What's happened is that the mine is filled with water up to the level of the tunnel. In other words, the lower half of the mine is full of water. And it's been in contact with the ore body, so it's got the same problems of acidity and heavy metal pollution. And that water then just comes out the tunnel of the mine on down the hill into Railroad Creek. What they tried to do in 1991 was to line the bed of this stream with chunks of limestone so that that would buffer the acidity and cause some of the metals to drop out before they got into Railroad Creek. But pretty soon the limestone got covered over with scum of precipitate. But this is the stream coming out of the portal. So it looked roughly 5 years ago. There you see some of the erosion control fabric, and here some of the riprap to protect the piles. Now, a couple questions came up after this project was finished. First and foremost, who should pay for this project? And that's a big question in environmental issues. And so after the Forest Service finished this project, they were able to use some funding that was available to them through the Forest Service, but they went looking for someone to pay the cost of this. Of course, the natural choice would be the mining company. They made the mess, they ought to pay for cleaning it up. Except that Howe Sound doesn't exist anymore. They were bought out and then bought out again and bought out again, so that it took several years of detective work, financial detective work, to find out who now owns the assets of Howe Sound Mining Company. As it turns out, that's a Washington Metals company called Intalco, except that they're a subsidiary of a French corporation. And so working out all the ownership and then getting in contact with these people about paying the costs or the liability they were facing took quite a long time. But then the second question is, was this enough? Was all this work in 90 and 91 enough to solve the problems? So beginning in the late 1990s, mid to late 1990s, began a long period of environmental testing and monitoring to see if there were still some environmental problems here at the Holden mine site. And one of the primary concerns was still the water pollution issues. And especially a strong focus on the tailings piles and water that was still seeping out of the tailings. Along the base of pile one, you can find places where water is seeping to the surface here before it gets into Railroad Creek, and often those areas are discolored by chemicals that are precipitating out of the water. So there clearly is water coming from the tailings that contains dissolved minerals, and that material is readily getting into Railroad Creek. So the tailings still represent a water pollution source. In spite of what they tried to do with the interception channels, that part of the problem was not solved. This is another one of those areas where water is seeping out of the tailings. You can see mineral deposits on the gravel here that come from the water that seeps out of the tailings. So this is just a group of environmental scientists looking at those deposits. Here you see gravel in the stream bed that's coated with iron. One of the major mineral constituents coming out of the tailings is dissolved iron. Once it gets into the water, it precipitates back into solid very quickly, literally cementing the stream bed. The bed of Railroad Creek is cemented with iron. And of course, if all the rocks are cemented together, there's no place for insects to live. And insects can't live there. There's no food for trout to eat. So there's some impacts on the stream ecosystem. So biologists came in. They did studies of trout populations and insect populations upstream and downstream from the mine site, comparing other streams in the area. They did electroshocking to count trout populations. They even had scuba divers in the water counting trout, looking at insects. So very thorough analysis of the stream ecosystem effects. They did sampling of sediment down in Lake Chelan, down at the mouth of Railroad Creek, to see how much of this tailing sediment had made it down into Lake Chelan. They did other kinds of biological analysis and testing of the vegetation to see if there were chemical constituents showing up in the vegetation downwind from here. And so this whole environmental monitoring and testing effort was pretty extensive. Now, one of the most dramatic things they did as part of this was to reopen the mine. The main tunnel here, the main portal, had collapsed and caved in the time since the mine closed. And the water that's filling the mine shaft had partially filled up the tunnel behind that earthen dam inside. So what they had to do to get into the mine was first go up above. You can see someone with a yellow hard hat up there. They had to tunnel down from up above to get behind that caved-in area and then pump as much water out as they could before they could then go in and reopen the mine shaft. So they tore out the old portal, began to dig into the hillside. It's a mining company out of Idaho that came in literally to make a new mine tunnel. This is what a caved-in mine tunnel looks like. You can see the collapsed timbers, the rocks. Oh, there was about 100 feet of that that they had to get through, getting the old timbers out of the way, getting all the debris out of the way, and building a new tunnel with new supports to be able to get back in there. So some of the mining equipment, some of the miners themselves, working their way farther back. And this is what they found once they got into the rock part of the mine, that through the collapse section into the bare rock. Railroad ties and mine timbers floating in water and what they called slime, iron precipitate that had collected behind there. So they had to drain all that slime out of there and into a settling pond to be able to haul it off. So this is some of that drainage process. You can see the water coming out of the mine. And then finally worked their way back inside there as best they could through that slimy stuff. You see, it was a very pleasant process to get back in there. And finally, this is the mine tunnel mostly cleared out. This is inside the tunnel, looking back at the portal, the light there. You can see high water marks here on the side of the tunnel, so you can see it was mostly full of water. Some of the railroad ties that came out. There's so much water coming out of the mine, they still wanted to control that, so they rebuilt bulkheads, little dams inside the tunnel to hold back the water. So now to go into the tunnel, you actually have to ride a boat into the tunnel. You kind of pull yourself along the side of the tunnel through this water that's been ponded up intentionally now. And once you get finally about 1,000 feet into the tunnel, then it's shallow enough you can step out of the boat and just wade from there. But the inside the tunnel is very fascinating. A lot of the mine workings and equipment is still in there. This is the shaft. Once you're half a mile into the mountain, there's a vertical shaft that goes up and down. So this is what's left of that shaft area. This was the hoist room with the big winches that raised and lowered the elevators. So this room, the hoist equipment is taken out, but you can still see the ceiling and the lights of the hoist room. Once it was open and safe, then environmental scientists could go in. The question here is, how is the water moving through the mine? How is it getting polluted as it comes through the mine? Could we possibly do something to control the flow of water through the mine, block off the water, keep it out, block out the air so that oxygen doesn't get in? The process that goes on, both in the tailings and in the mine, is that first, oxygen comes in contact with the ore, and the oxidation process decomposes the sulfide ore, which then makes it easier for water to dissolve those minerals as the water drips through the mine or percolates through the tailings. So lots of sampling of water in various levels of the mine. This is an attempt to send water samples down the shaft, down to the deeper part of the mine. More collection equipment there. And then finally a new portal was built, and what you don't see behind the plastic is that there's now a locked door. And then this pipe is to direct the water out so the water can still keep flowing and won't get ponded up and cause a sudden flood coming out of there. Even if the mine tunnel were to collapse again, it still ought to be able to flow through that pipe. They had some trouble with their new tunnel caving a little bit, but they were able to get that repaired, and this is some of that area where it caved in a little bit on top of the shaft. The shaft didn't cave in, but some of the fill up above slipped. All around the valley are monitoring wells to also monitor groundwater. The question isn't just, is the surface water polluted, but also is the groundwater polluted? So these wells have been installed. Someone comes in with a drill rig to drill holes in the ground to create the wells to keep monitoring water quality. They're still doing samples of Lake Chelan sediments, so this is that sampling process. They're taking water samples from Lake Chelan. One of the interesting questions about the mine is whether the mine is now being used by bats in lieu of a natural cave. So biologists came in to do studies about whether bats were using it. That certainly would affect whether they could close off the tunnels or not. They even install bat counters, infrared counters, so if a bat flies through the beam of light, it gets counted, and that's one way they can monitor bat activity without having to have someone living in the mine tunnel. So this whole process was pretty complicated, lots of different questions they're trying to answer, and not surprisingly, this is all pretty expensive. So that adds to what Intalco is having to pay in terms of the expenses of dealing with this situation. So, the end result of that was that the primary ongoing environmental concern in this valley is water pollution. Water seeping out of the tailings into Railroad Creek all along here. But one of the interesting things they found out is that the water coming out of the mine shaft accounts for almost half of the pollution load in Railroad Creek. So in other words, that pollution coming out of the mine was a big part of the problem. The tailings certainly are a pollution source, but the mine was also. And no one realized quite how much the mine was a source of pollution. So now the question becomes, what else can you do to solve these problems? So after the environmental studies were completed to define the problem, then another set of studies were initiated to come up with possible alternatives. Feasibility study, it was called. And the idea was to come up with as many possible alternatives as you could. And so in the end, there were approximately 9, ranging from solution number 1, which was do nothing, to solution number 9, which basically involved piling everything all on one space and sealing off the tailings with some kind of water-resistant cover. Many of those solutions had alternatives B, C, and D. So ultimately, there were probably 30 different possible solutions. And I can't take time to go through all of them because that in itself is an hour-long presentation. But we can talk about a few of the potential solutions. Now, almost certainly, somewhere here on the valley bottom, kind of up valley from the footbridge, there will be a water treatment plant for the water that comes out of the mine shaft, out of the mine tunnel. So some kind of plant to treat that water before it gets into Railroad Creek. That's pretty much guaranteed to be part of the next remediation effort. It may be an active system like you'd see in a small town. It may be a passive system that involves some artificial wetlands that allow the metals and pollutants to settle out, but there'll be some kind of water treatment facility. There's also concern about these piles up on the hillside that water seeping through those may be a pollution source, and there's a seep here where water coming down the mountainside seeps into Railroad Creek. So that water is likely to be collected and sent over to the water treatment plant. It's likely that the old mill structure will be taken down, because when Howe Sound quit, they just turned off the switches and walked away. So there's ore unprocessed up in the bins of that old mill. And that ore is a pollution source. So to get the ore out, they pretty much got to take down the whole mill structure. So that'll likely come down. The blue lines represent diversion walls. Not diversion ditches like they had in 91, but diversion walls, again, to divert water around the piles from uphill. Those are pretty much guaranteed to be part of the solution. Now, the real question is what, if anything, to do about the tailings? Because remember, that's the other part of the pollution source. And that's much more complicated. The mine tunnel's kind of easy because that's just a single point source. You can just direct that flow right into your water treatment plant. But the tailings stretch on for nearly a mile, and water's seeping out pretty much along their whole length. It's a lot harder to capture that seepage out of the tailings than out of the mine tunnel. The proposal is where this bright green line is on the diagram. The proposal is to put a wall there, between the bottom of the tailings pile and the creek, a wall that goes down below the surface to keep water from seeping out of the tailings into the creek. You're going to block off that seepage with a wall. And initially, the proposal was to take that wall all the way down to bedrock, so nothing could possibly get underneath it. Now, the problem is that places along there, bedrock is over 80 feet down. So if you're going to build a concrete wall 80 feet down below the surface in a trench, that's a pretty elaborate construction process. Now, the agencies have backed off a little bit about how deep it needs to be, but they still want the wall there, because overseeing this project are several federal and state agencies. Of course, the Forest Service, the Environmental Protection Agency, those are the main federal agencies. And then the State Department of Ecology is the main state agency. Now, others are involved, but those are the three lead agencies. They've got to agree to the final solution. In fact, they have to pick the final solution. And what they'd like to see is something that blocks off that seepage from Railroad Creek. In the areas outlined by black, they also kind of want the edge of the tailings peeled back a little bit, cut back a little bit so it's not so steep. So they may recontour the edge of the tailing piles just so they're a little bit smoother on that edge that's by Railroad Creek. And then if the wall is built, then that will divert water down into another water treatment plant down at the lower end of the tailings pile, so that water will be treated before it goes into Railroad Creek. This is pretty close to the most popular solution at the moment, which you see represented by this diagram. The problem is that the Intalco doesn't want to pay for this wall, because that would just about double the cost of the project. And they're not convinced it would accomplish that much in terms of additional pollution protection. That's the stumbling block, is that green line there, whether to build the wall or not. So what has to happen at this point, this is the solution the agencies that are saying they like, and Intalco is saying, well, we don't like all of it, and they have to keep negotiating with each other until they reach a point where they have a solution that the agencies like and Intalco is willing to pay for. And we're not there yet. So I can't ultimately tell you for sure what's going to be done at this site to clean up the water pollution issues. But this is kind of in the neighborhood where people are thinking about right now. So that negotiation process has taken longer than people expected because of this wall. The agencies keep wanting it, and Intalco keeps dragging their feet on it. That's still the thing that's keeping the two sides apart.
What's the cost estimate?
Well, without the wall, it might be in the range of $40 to $50 million. With the wall, maybe double that.
What about the surface? Will the surface be covered at all?
The surface would probably still get the gravel restored, where they peel it away and then revegetate it. If you try to put an impervious surface on here, whether it's clay, which would be the most common kind of surface, then you've got to keep trees off of it. The tree roots would penetrate through the covering. So right now, they aren't looking at any kind of impervious covering. They're hoping that the diversion wall above and the diversion wall below would take care of most of the seepage.
Is Holden legally responsible for what?
Well, that's a good question too. Because Holden owns part of Copper Mountain where the mine is, so they're the owners of part of the mine. And in the eyes of the legislation, that makes them a principally potentially responsible party. But what Holden doesn't have are very deep pockets. If you're thinking about a $40 to $80 million cleanup project, you're not going to get your legal fees out of Holden Village.
But I can't think of a more concentrated political base than what you've got here if you chose to use it. My gosh, you got senators across the nation that you can get over the head with this.
And Holden is aware of that. Yeah.
Malco must be really aware of that as well.
Yeah. And one of the criteria for choosing the final solution is that Holden continue to be able to operate and exist as it does now, so that the final solution can't wipe out the village in terms of its operation here. If the agencies and the company get together and finally agree on a solution, then it would also open up to a period of public comment where anybody would be able to respond to this potential solution.
Obviously, dumping it, scraping it, and shoveling back into the mine shaft was not feasible or advantageous.
Well, it certainly is a logical idea. And
they pump the water out and open the shaft.
No. A couple of things get in the way of that. One is they're not all going to fit. Because when you grind them up, you also fluff them up. The tailings are essentially 50% airspace now. Mm-hmm. And so that volume is not going to fit back in the space they took it out of. So there's no way you can get rid of all of them, and you'd still have to then get rid of some of them. And remobilizing the tailings to get them to move back up into the mountain would be a still more expensive option than what's being considered right now. But it certainly has been considered, has been very seriously considered. Other questions? We've had some good ones so far.
Does Holden take its drinking water out of Railroad Creek?
No. Drinking water for Holden comes out of Copper Creek, which is the one coming down through the piles. But you see this little slanted road up here? It leads up to our diversion dam. So the water's diverted high above any of the mine stuff. That's the diversion dam, both for the hydroelectric plant that provides our electricity, and that's the diversion dam for our water supply. Here's the village again. And the ballpark is not quite there, right out here. This is the miners' village. So the ballpark's sitting right out about here. These are the trees of the campground right here.
So we're pumping our water out of the creek?
You're upstream of everything but this one seepage here. If you're getting water from the creek by the campground.
How many other mining situations like this exist in the state of Washington?
In Washington, that's a good question. I'm not so sure. We've got a bunch of them in the West. Montana, Idaho, California, Colorado. We've got mine sites like this all over the place, and as mine sites go, this is not a very bad one.
This isn't considered a Superfund site?
No, there's no Superfund money being used for this, but it is being remediated under the CERCLA legislation that created the Superfund, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. And that created the Superfund, but it also, the more important part of that piece of legislation was that it is the legislation that gave the federal government the ability to go after who made the mess.
Right.
And so by remediating under CERCLA, that they've got the federal authority to go to a Talco and say, you got to pay for it.
And it sounds like Talco gets to choose what they pay.
Yeah, they have agreed already that they will be responsible for the costs. Both the cost of the initial gravel cover, the cost of all the environmental monitoring, and the cost of what needs to be done. So they've made that agreement already. It was settled out of court. But what they're not just buying into completely is all the solution that the agencies want.
Of course.
And so they're still negotiating. It doesn't mean it won't ultimately go to court. If they can't ever get together, it could potentially go to court to get the final settlement. But
and once that's decided, how long would it take to do this?
tossing in the wall, it's probably a 4 to 5 year construction project. And if the wall is going in, that's a noisy project for Holden. So that would be a little bit of an issue.
Hey, Rick, if they put the wall, would they have to put a cement plant up here or someplace to...
Yeah, I suppose they would.
Yeah, you'd have to, it's an incredible amount of...
No. And they'd have to bring in all that...
Yeah, a tent village for the workers.
Yeah, there's some proposal that they would create a tent village for the workers in the miners' village. Essentially, something in the range of 80 workers living up here.
So that wouldn't affect our septic system that much, then?
No, they'd have to come up with their own solution for septic and water and that sort of thing.
Would the truck traffic go through the village, or would it go around the village?
Well, in 1991, it crossed the river down here and stayed all away from the village. So there's a hope that the majority of the traffic would still divert around the village this time.
Is that bridge still there?
No, it's not at the moment, but a new one could be put back in. It was a temporary one built with culverts and then dirt piled over it, and then those were taken out. So you can see it's a pretty complicated issue. But interesting to watch what's happening, certainly. From a standpoint of a geologist like myself, it's been a fascinating look at how environmental cleanups work or don't work, depending on how the negotiations go.
How would you change the Mining Act to make this more clearly responsibility of Manitoba?
Well, the mining law of 1872, is it? Or
yeah.
Somewhere in that range, doesn't require any cleanup.
I know. What should we change it to? That's a...
No. The one thing that's changed quite a bit is that most of our modern U.S. metals mining is surface mining, and that is any new surface mining is under the control of the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, so that has more stringent control over the contemporary mines. But something like this, you need the CERCLA legislation to be able to cope with after the fact.
But if the cost of minerals goes up dramatically, there'll be a lot more expensive, a lot more of this kind
of
thing.
Yeah, a lot more pressure on places like this. Yeah. Question back there?
Well, how long before those cement walls develop cracks and allow water to go through it? And
yeah, I don't know about that technology very much. They're called slurry walls, so I don't know exactly how they would guarantee that, but I think they'd be vulnerable. It's a tough thing to guarantee that it's going to be an impermeable barrier long enough to make a difference.
It seems like it would be worthwhile if you could get some kind of variance on land applying sewage to encourage tree growth that would intercept some of the surface water going into the system that would allow those cement walls to maybe last longer if they have less
pressure behind
surface
them.
Water pressure behind them.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it must be a county regulation because they're still land applying sewage in Skagit County and Whatcom County. And there they're doing it on impervious clays in a rainy climate, which is dumb.
It's asking for some motion, isn't it?
How bad is the problem? I mean, Lake Chelan, for example, what has been the impact? What did they measure?
There's no measurable pollution from the mine showing up in any samples of Lake Chelan water.
Any heavy metals in the fish? In the creek?
No.
No. What about the sediments in the lake?
There are sediments at the mouth of Railroad Creek. So there is some accumulation of the mine sediments, the tailings there. So it's not nothing, but the volume of Lake Chelan is such that what pollution is coming from the mine and the tailings is highly diluted by the time it gets to.
So what was the percentage decrease in trout population from upstream to downstream?
I can't give you the percentage numbers. There is clearly diminished insect and trout life from the end of the tailings downstream for about 5 miles. And then it returns back to normal about that point in terms of the insect and trout population. give credit to Norm Day of the Forest Service. He's the man who's been shepherding this project through as far as it's gotten so far, and also provided many of these images that we've been enjoying here.
Tom Alstrom just mentioned that there had been a recent setback. Has something happened recently?
All that I'm aware of is, again, a failure to reach a compromise, to reach an agreement. And so, in effect, the setback, as I understand it, is the agency saying, no, we're not going to give on this. And Italco is still saying, we're not going to pay for it. So it looked like, it's been looking over the last year like they're getting closer and closer together, and then all of a sudden it seems like they're not any closer together than they were a year or two ago. So it's just kind of a lack of progress. There was some, when Norm first started talking about this, he thought we'd be almost finished by 2007 with all the construction work. So clearly we haven't even begun the construction work by 2007. So things have gone more slowly than expected, even with what seemed like a smooth process as we get started. Well, there have been some great questions, so I appreciate your attention. Thanks for coming. And then certainly if you've got questions, more questions about this, feel free to chat with me and catch some of our other museum programs later in the week.